everyone. Welcome back from the break. The Ways and Means Committee will come to order. The clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of March 26th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Are there any questions, additions, or changes to the minutes? See none. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
I have a quick question. Before the break, I asked about the House budget resolution, and you indicated that it would probably be sometime soon after the break. And I was wondering if you have a date certain yet in terms of when we would be potentially taking up the budget resolution.
Representative Carlson, I don't have a date certain. I would guess it will probably be later this week. I would say Wednesday or Thursday, but I don't, probably more likely Thursday than Wednesday. But I don't have a date certain for you.
Okay, and then a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Is your plan then to share that with the minority prior to the meeting?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, seeing none, we're going to start with a couple of the bills of members that are not members of the committee. We're going to do first House File 3610 with Representative Johnson, then House File 3280 with Representative Lewick, then House File 1415, Representative Albright, then House File 3023, Representative Dean, and finally the Baker bill. So with that, Representative Johnson, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means, and the Chair will move that House File 3610 be referred to the General Register. Representative Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to have that little break that we had to get everybody back. Now we have to get everybody back in the swing of things. House File 3610 deals with changing the penalty for assaulting a police officer from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. We've had, to me this is important, because if somebody assaults a police officer, they're willing to assault anybody. We're getting more and more instances where officers have been targeted, and we do need to put a stop to that, because those officers are putting their lives on the line to protect every one of us.
Thank you.
I myself have been in situations where I was on a call of a domestic, walked down the stairs to talk to the suspect. The original call was a mother-child domestic. I walked into the basement. I had two steps left to go. And the child, who happened to be about 22 years old, was described as Jerry Blackwell's twin brother, if any of you remember Jerry Blackwell from wrestling. Did a back kick, fortunately went over my head, and the battle was on. I had my jacket pulled over my head. He's trying to get my firearm out of my holster. It was one of the few times I literally said to myself during the battle, I was going to die. I was not hurt once it was said and done. His father and his brother, who was just as big as him, helped me. Along with another officer, we were able to subdue him and handcuff the gentleman. But I wasn't injured. It was barely a misdemeanor. I didn't even qualify for a misdemeanor assault, even though he wasn't resisting arrest at that time when he tried to assault me. He later was arrested. And situations like that is what causes a lot of officers to be injured, and a lot of times there's not a lot they can do. On the prosecution side, and I also understand there's a difference between resisting arrest and assault. We now have across the country issues where an officer will be standing there talking to somebody, and somebody will come up behind him and cold cock him, causing injury and injury. That needs to stop. These officers are there to protect us and to help us in any situation. Because generally when there's trouble, it's the officers that are the first ones running in to help us. And with that, I'm open to any questions.
Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So under current law, it is already, where an assault leads to an injury, it already carries a penalty of a felony, as I understand it. That's current law.
Representative Addendum
to that. My understanding is in public safety, Representative Ward asked for a question, for a definition of assault, and that phrase was intent to cause fear. I mean, if that really is the definition for assault in the current climate, could one imagine that this could be misused if the definition of assault is intent to cause fear?
Representative Johnson.
I don't believe it could be misused. I literally was not injured, but I was in fear for my life. Because I was not injured, but there was very little penalty that they could do. They could have done the gross misdemeanor, but I was literally in a battle for my life. I was in immediate fear of my life. I could literally have used deadly force under that definition, but I did not. I don't want anybody assaulting a peace officer. Because they're there to protect us. They're willing to put their lives on the line. And for somebody to come up to them, behind them, and assault them, if they'll do that to a peace officer, they'll do that to anybody. And we're having that issue going on now.
Representative Houseman.
Just to clarify then. So if there's an assault that leads to injury, it is already a felony. If it is an assault that where there is no injury, it is a gross misdemeanor under current law.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, that is true. But if they're assaulting a peace officer, his life is in danger. Because, and that's why I feel it doesn't matter if you're injured or not. If you assault a peace officer, they're threatening their life. And there's something that this... Unfortunately, I think this country is lacking. I don't know how we're going to deal with it, and that is respect. I have a lot of respect for my fellow officers. I have a lot of respect for all the members here. But we have a lot of people that don't have respect anymore, respect for anything. And those are the people that are causing the problem. And because of that, and that lack of respect for people, I think we need to up the ante a little bit. So they understand that assaulting a peace officer and assaulting anybody is wrong. But assaulting a peace officer, they're the ones there to protect everybody else.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I raise this, because I work on housing issues, I have heard the stories of many people, this intent to cause fear. So once in their life, they do something that someone says, there was an intent to cause fear. That person has now a felony. Unless they're very, very lucky, for the rest of their life, they're going to have trouble getting a job and getting a place to live. I mean, I've had people in my office telling me those stories. So, I mean, this is not a little thing we're doing. This is not a little thing we're doing.
Well, Representative Johnson, just to clarify, so my understanding of the current law is if someone assaults a police officer and is successful in injuring them, then under the current law they would get a felony. But if they do the exact same thing but are unsuccessful in injuring them, then they wouldn't get a felony. Is that the state of the current law?
That is correct.
Gross misdemeanor.
Well, they wouldn't get a felony. I said, yes, they'd get a gross misdemeanor. It just seems to me that if someone assaults a police officer and happens to be unsuccessful in their assault, that they should be equally guilty as to whether they were successful in it. But I got several people. I got Representative Liebling, I got Representative Anderson, I have Representative Hillstrom. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to comment on, Mr. Chair, what you just said, I think you're talking about an attempted, it could be, for instance, if someone swings a deadly weapon at you and misses, that's an attempted, I think, second-degree assault. So that's still a felony. what we're talking about here with what's usually a misdemeanor assault, which is, you know, putting someone, intentionally putting them in fear, is different than intending to actually hurt them. Okay, those are two different things. Already, the penalty is higher if that person is a police officer, because normally that would be a regular misdemeanor. With a police officer, it's already a gross misdemeanor. So it carries up to a year in jail and a $3,000 fine for someone who presumably was just trying to create a feeling of fear, but not necessarily trying to actually cause injury. So I just want to make that distinction. But I wanted to ask Representative Johnson, I'm sorry, I can't see you very well here, but when at the time that this happened to you, was the law already, was it already a gross misdemeanor to assault a police officer?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lubin, I do not remember. That was back in 1992. But at that time, I don't think there was any charges for that because I was not injured. Although I was covered with his blood and some other body fluids, and the gentleman refused to do any testing, so I was doing other testings for the next 6 months.
So, Representative Lubin.
Well, Mr. Chair, in Representative Johnson, you know, there are sort of two clauses of simple assault, and the other one is fighting or brawling. And so, you know, it's really hard for me to believe at that time that what you're talking about, that there wasn't already a criminal penalty. Now, maybe it wasn't as high as it is now. But, you know, I just wanted to make the point that even though, or let me ask you, Representative Johnson, I mean, right now, with a simple assault on a police officer bringing a gross misdemeanor penalty, are police officers still being assaulted?
Yes, they are.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lubin, yes, they are.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, and so I think the bottom line here is that, and of course, we know that injuring the police officer is already a felony. So I think what we could draw from this is that the criminal penalties do not stop people from doing this. So, you know, it may stop some people, but I think that there are very few people that in the heat of wanting to hurt a police officer or get into a fight with a police officer, especially since, as you noted, the police officer already could kill them. Right? The police officer is armed and could, in fact, respond by using deadly force. So a person is risking quite a bit already if they do this. I think it is very, very unlikely that upping the penalty is going to actually prevent someone. People don't stop and say, it's a gross misdemeanor, or is it a felony? If it's a felony, I think I won't do it. I don't think human beings actually think that way. And if you think they do, then we should really think about changing our gun laws. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I assume what you're looking to do is to use this as a deterrent for individuals assaulting police officers and potentially de-escalating a situation. Is this a tool to de-escalate so we don't have a situation where some unintended consequences happen as a result? Is that kind of the goal of this, or can you help me out?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that is the goal of this, as a deterrent, hopefully, and also to de-escalate situations. When law enforcement is involved in a situation where an assault or an attempted assault, we have to use what's called the force continuum. We can only use so much force above to stop the threat. If the threat is a fist fight, or somebody throwing their fists, unless it's a professional wrestler whose fist technically could be a deadly force, we only can use just a little bit more above that to subdue the situation, whether it's going into hand-to-hand combat or using a chemical agent or a taser. The last thing an officer ever wants to do is take somebody's life. I've been in those situations. where I've been actually pulling on the trigger. I've been in situations where we've actually, fortunately it wasn't me, but another officer did have to take it. Use deadly force on an individual and he did not survive. Most officers don't survive, their careers don't survive those situations because it's very difficult for them to deal with. That's what I'm trying to end. I'm trying to end those situations so we don't have them.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, can you tell me on line 1.9, section B, where it says whoever physically assaults, do we know, is there any interpretation, any court interpretation of what physically assaults means? I see in the fiscal note that there have been 103 convictions for this, but I'm curious as to how many were actual physical touching or assaulting where no harm was caused or which ones were feared. Do we know?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not aware of it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we can talk about that and see if we can't get some of that information. I understand the difference between actually placing your hands on someone and making someone afraid you might place their hands on someone, and so I hear Representative Liebling and Representative Hausman's concerns, and maybe there is a way to figure out if the court has already determined what physically assault means in the statute.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You know, our law enforcement officers, they're the line between order and chaos. And I don't know how there can be a simple assault on a police officer. I mean, where have we gone? I mean, there should be no assaults on police officers, and whether or not the officer is injured or not should not matter in this case. The intent is there, and when law enforcement officers feel that government leaders do not have their backs and they're questioning discretion and so forth, officers die at that point. Because you know, Representative Johnson, that if you have an officer in a life-threatening situation, have to hesitate because they don't know they have the backing of our society and our government officials, that split second of waiting could be the difference between life and death. And so, I don't think it matters. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I don't think it matters if the officer is injured or not. The intent is there to attack an officer. I mean, the fact that we're even talking about this, where has society gone when we're hedging over assaults on officers, whether or not it should be a serious crime or not? It should be. Police officers are the final line. They provide the most important service we provide to people, and that's public safety. And if we're questioning their judgment, it's going to be serious, not only for our law enforcement officers, but for the people they're trying to protect. And so I support your bill.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Johnson, for bringing the bill forward and bringing attention to the rotting and the moral decay of our society as we continue to see increasingly the amount of assaults, both by people who get involved in these confrontations, as has not been unique here in Minnesota or elsewhere around the country. I think everybody has kind of touched already on the things that I was concerned about, but with regards to your expression of fearing for your life, I think the use of lethal force is a very, very powerful deterrent to not do anything to a police officer, and I applaud what you're trying to do, but I also share some concerns whether or not it will make a difference in those split-second decisions, and where once you've reached that threshold where you think you're going to die as you've testified, you now have license to take another person's life, and that's a very, very serious situation that I don't know that a felony charge is going to make a difference in that decision. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate appreciate it. My big fear is they're not going to be people that want to be police officers anymore. When are we going to have a shortage of nurses first, teachers second? Now, when are we going to have a shortage of law enforcement officers? Because they don't want the job, because they have to fear for their life. They have to deal with people that are mentally capable of making appropriate decisions. Maybe we should offer a scholarship for psychiatrists and psychologists and do the best thing we can for people that are going to be in danger.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, we already have that issue now. About a month ago in the Minneapolis Star St. Paul Police Department had an article, they could not find officers for the filler positions. This is going all over the state. There's job openings all over. There's people that are applying for the jobs, but they don't qualify. And because in Minnesota, we have probably the best trained officers in the country. We're one of the few states that require licensing before you can even apply for the job. And that's a minimum 2 years of college and plus some other programs. We require testing. We require psychological evaluations. We do thorough background checks. We don't have people that can pass the background checks and the psychological evaluations in a large enough degree that we can fill the positions we have now.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Johnson, do you have any last comments on the bill?
Mr. Chair, members, it's unfortunate I had to bring this bill forward, but unfortunately, I believe this is something that we do need to do. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, the Chair will renew his motion that House Bill 3610 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. House Bill 3610 is referred to the General Register.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is House Bill 3280, Representative Lewick. Representative Lewick, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 3280 be referred to the General Register, and there is an amendment. I believe this is an author's amendment. Chair will move the A8 amendment. Representative Lewick, can you speak to the A8 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. The A8 amendment, I worked specifically with folks in the DNR to better clarify the deliverables of the report that we're asking that the Commissioner DNR provide. And so what that does is just simply tries to make sure we know exactly what we're asking for and define what that product should be.
Okay, any discussion of the A8 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A8 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A8 amendment is adopted. Representative Lewick, can you present House Bill 3280 as amended?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with a 45-year-old wild rice sulfite standard and recent rulemaking activity by MPCA to replace that standard. However, this bill is specifically before this committee because we're asking for a $50,000 appropriation from the Heritage Enhancement Account in the Game and Fish Fund. That money would go to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to prepare a report for the legislature and tribal governments on how best to preserve and improve our existing wild rice beds in Minnesota. The amendment outlines, we've asked for four basic deliverables in that report. You see, those were by agreement with the DNR. Those were something we could get done in the time frame we asked. We want that report available to the legislature no later than the 15th of January of 2019. A little history, the rest of the bill deals with the the standard itself and the rulemaking, those areas have been through hearings with the Natural Resource Environmental Finance Committee and also Government Ops and Elections, which respectfully have jurisdiction over those areas. So with that, I would be available for questions on the matter before you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and members, underneath House rules, we do take testimony in committee. If someone requests to testify for or against the bill, we don't, of course, have unlimited time, and so a chair at his discretion will often limit it to one opponent and one proponent. And I do have Commissioner Stein from the MPCA that had requested to testify on the bill, and so I'm going to call him forward. I don't know if anyone else who wants to testify. If there is someone that does, please send the chair a note. Then after the testimony of Mr. Stein, and if there is anyone else, some other testimony, we'll go to member questions. Commissioner Stein, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your accommodation this morning for the opportunity to speak to House File 3280. Our agency had been working to submit comments to the administrative law judge on the rulemaking process, which meant in previous testimony of the before other committees, the agency was very constrained in making public comments. We filed those comments with the chief administrative law judge now, and I'm here this morning to speak to this bill in its entirety. I'll be as brief as I can, Mr. Chair, recognizing your time constraints. Mr. Chair, there are a couple major trends going on in our work today. One of the trends is the ballooning of our new water infrastructure costs, which are impacting communities all across the nation, but seriously all across Minnesota. The other fact that's occurring is the ability to detect micro levels of contaminants in our waterways, in our bodies of water, including mercury. Think about all sorts of things. But having these two things happen at the same time, our infrastructure costs, updating our aging infrastructure, largely which was built between the 1940s and the 1980s, and is now at its life's end or past, and the ability to understand our water quality more effectively puts us at a crossroads of very serious ethical complications for the government, myself as commissioner, trying to protect water resources and assure affordable water quality treatment across the state of Minnesota. I have a handout, Mr. Chair, that I think is in the members' packets, a letter that we signed today to the various chairs outlining our concerns, and I just would pause for a moment for members to locate that letter. It's a five-page letter that goes on to detail our reasons for opposing House File 3280. And I will just give you three quick reasons, Mr. Chair. First is the bill represents an attack on the science. It is an attack on the old science, and it's an attack on the new science. It stands no reason to me that we would not want to utilize the science to protect wild rice in the future. Many have testified that sulfate is not harming wild rice. That's not the case. Sulfate has the potential to harm wild rice. The fact that we have existing stands of wild rice across the state demonstrates that there are facilities operating and successfully treating water quality and not impairing wild rice at the current time, but there are threats, and those threats should be taken into consideration in the future. So the bill not only stands to prevent the agency from using the new science that's been developed over the past 6 years with legislative direction and partial funding, but it also stands to throw out the old science, the 10 milligram per liter standard that existed. And by doing so, we would have no water quality standard to protect wild rice going forward. The second major reason is that if that were to occur and we had no standard that would apply, we think there would be an avalanche of litigation that would play out in front of the permitting work of our agency, meaning the Minnesota taxpayers would have to fund the response to all of those actions in litigation. Third, Mr. Chair, the There's not been a discussion in any committee yet about Section 7 of the bill, which would prevent the agency from implementing water quality standards to ensure irrigation water does not harm crops or soil, and that's another reason we oppose this bill. Lastly, in conclusion, Mr. Chair, the costs that face our communities across the state are real. They're not unknown to us. We think that there are about 300 some mechanical treatment plants that are upstream of wild rice waters. Actually, only about 25% of the proposed wild rice waters are downstream of wastewater treatment facilities, so the impacts are simply overstated by opponents. And we think that there are ways to address that using the tools under the Clean Water Act and under existing rules, but we need to have a water quality standard for wild rice updated. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, we are focused on protecting wild rice going forward so that people and wildlife can use this valuable resource in our state. It is our state grain, as you know, and we oppose this bill because it would not allow us to protect wild rice going forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd answer any questions you might have.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, prior to the study that MPCA did for the last 7 years, what kind of measures did the MPCA do in checking water? So in your enforcement of the 10 milligram, what did you do on a yearly basis to check that water was in compliance with the old standard?
So there were, Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple of permits that had requirements in them for water quality for sulfate. We monitor the water quality on a permit-by-permit basis based on the reports that permittees make, and we did that for a couple of facilities prior to the current standard, which we've been we have not expanded the implementation of the current standard because of legislation that restricts that.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so the 30 to 40 years that the current standard was in place, are you saying there was maybe five times that permits were explored? Did you ever go back after a permit was granted to check that it was actually being complied with? Can you tell me the history of that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the history is unclear to me, and we've tried our best to figure out what did happen over those intervening years. There were two facilities that I'm aware of that are currently permitted for sulfate discharges. Those requirements mandate in our permits that they report their discharge levels, but we're not taking any enforcement action on those, as I said, because of the legislation that would restrict us from doing so.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, for the last 30 to 40 years that the 10 milligram standard was in place, you can't verify that there was any check by the MPCA that the law was actually being followed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that we have done what we can under the law to assure that wild rice is monitored. We've looked at receiving waters downstream of facilities. Our monitoring work on watershed conditions has definitely expanded since the 2008 Clean Water Fund expansion. But on permit levels, there's been very limited investigation.
Okay, I have Representative Fabian and then Wagenius and members. I do think that we should be mostly talking about the fiscal aspects of the bill, but I do want to leave things open for members to ask questions. And I guess, again, if there's a, since Mr. Stein has testified as an opponent to the legislation, if there is a proponent that wants to testify, I want to accommodate them as well. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I would point out for members that the fiscal aspect of this does not impact MPCA. It's DNR. Okay, so DNR is the one that should be here testifying, Mr. Chair, and from the best of my knowledge, they have no interest in doing that. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. You've said in your letter that you sent to myself and Senator Ingebrigtsen and a couple of others that due to legal constraints, and you addressed this a little bit, when this bill was before our environment committee, not only did you say he provided very limited testimony, your agency refused to testify in front of the Environment Committee at that time regarding this. Can you expand on that, please?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fabian, the agency was under Chapter 14 responding to the Administrative Law Judge's report on our rules. We decided, and it was based on advice of the legal advisors that told me that it could jeopardize the agency's remarks to the Chief of the Administrative Law Judge if we were to express our concerns and our response to the Administrative Law Judge's report publicly before the committee. Because the bill addresses many of the items that the Law Judge's report addressed, we felt like we would be crossing that line of publicly speaking about something that we were personally responsible for under the law as the executive branch, fulfilling the response to the Chief ALJ. So we filed that response, and now we're more able to testify in complete detail.
Representative Fabian.
So, Commissioner, did that advice come to you from your attorneys inside the MPCA, from the Attorney General?
That advice, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Fabian, was from our internal counsel as well as from my experience working with the Attorney General's office.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you in your letter that you sent to me, and I've received this just this morning, you talked about short-circuiting the administrative rulemaking process. That's the first bullet point at the bottom. How do you define short-circuiting? I mean, this has been going on for 7 years, as Chair Anderson has pointed out.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the short circuit refers to the fact that we're in the process of responding to the Chief Administrative Law Judge's concerns or the Administrative Law Judge's report, that we will then respond to the Chief ALJ, and it's possible that the Chief ALJ will find that there are ongoing issues that need to be addressed in our rule proposal, or that we have fully addressed the rule in the concerns that were expressed in the Administrative Law Judge's report. So we feel like that process should fulfill its due course, which could take us through the summer to complete.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your second bullet point, you say that we're going to waste significant investment of state resources understanding the, quote, science on sulfate impacts on wild rice. To the best of my knowledge and the testimony that we've heard in the Environment Committee, there's really no clear universal science on the impacts of sulfates on wild rice. The stuff that we're working off here now, the 10 milligrams per liter, goes back to some, quote, field observations from the 30s and the 40s. And the sulfate standard was adopted in the 70s, I believe. So help me out. Give me the clear science, on the impact of sulfate on wild rice.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the clear science is that the experiments in the field, the experiments in the test tubes, the experiments in mesocosms in field containers demonstrated a relationship that several scientific journals have accepted in publication, that there is a direct correlation between the level of sulfate in water that converts to sulfide in the sediments that is impacted by the levels of iron and organic carbon present in the water body. This relationship is clear. The science of that relationship is clear. What people disagree about is the level at which there is a trigger. That is not something like we could have an argument over how to build your roof on your house. One engineer might think this is safer than that because there's often disagreements among scientists, engineers, chemists, biologists over the level at which something becomes safe or unsafe or regulated for the benefit of a plant or not. That's the disagreement, Mr. Chair. It's not over the science. It's over the level at which there should be a standard.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also in your letter, Commissioner, you talk about the involvement of the EPA, and we're going to nullify the existing federally approved wild rice sulfate standard. At what point, I mean, are we just going to cede our, our state sovereignty to the EPA? When does the state of Minnesota, where do we start pushing back on this with the EPA?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we do that all the time. In fact, I think the bill actually cedes more authority to the EPA than it does to the state of Minnesota. That's why we oppose the bill, because we believe that it would be in our interest
to maintain our own regulatory authority over wild rice and water quality than to let some jurisdiction outside Minnesota make that definition for us.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then to that point, this bill was introduced about 2 months ago. And since that time, what direct conversations have you, Commissioner Stein, had with the new Region 5 EPA director with regards to wild rice?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I've had two conversations with the with Kathy Stepp, who is the regional administrator. I've notified her of our concerns over this legislation. I've also spoken with her regarding the existing standard and how the Clean Water Act would reconcile the fact that there was an approved standard applied in existing permits. She's aware of that concern of our position, and I know that she's spoken with others in that same regard.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know that she has, too. So my point in supporting the LUIC bill here is that in your final bullet point, you're talking about exacerbating existing regulatory uncertainty around the standards that apply to clean water or to water quality discharges. To the best of my knowledge, every regulated party that is impacted by this supports the LUIC bill largely because of the uncertainty that's involved in the current practices that MPC is imposing with regards to the standard. So I'm a strong supporter of this bill. I think that we need to move forward. And my final comment, Mr. Chair, is that I think that it's important that EPA understands that the administration is not the sole voice that they should be listening to in this process. And without us doing something like this, I mean, we are co-equal branches in government. And I think that it's critical that EPA receive a message from this body and the one across the street that these are the issues that we think that are important. And I have every reason to believe that Region 5 Administrator is going to listen to the concerns of the legislative body on this issue. So thank you.
Representative Oginius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, for Commissioner, for being here. Just want to note for the record that while we're talking about wild rice, sulfur does have other implications for our waters. And for chemical changes, for biological changes in our waters. That's not part of this, but as we are thinking ahead for Minnesotans, sulfur actually helps release nitrogen and phosphorus from sediments, I understand. And the commissioner is shaking his head, so I would like a response from him. We know we have an algae problem in Minnesota, which seems to be getting worse, and that sulfur can contribute to that. And then we have changing mercury into the form that gets into our fish. So we're not dealing with a narrow problem here. We're dealing with a broad problem. And would the commissioner agree with me on that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Luginius, yes, I would concur. I would also say that sulfate, like many salts in the environment, release and bind and can have interactions with other nutrients as well as other compounds, metallic compounds and otherwise. The other point that you made is that sulfur is not only a concern for wild rice plants, it's also a concern for drinking water. The amount of sulfate in our drinking water is restricted so that for human health, because too much sulfate in our water has an impact on our gut and gives people the runs. So we have standards that we set for a variety of purposes under water quality for drinking water programs as well as for clean water programs, and they are broad, and we're thinking broadly about how to address those going forward.
Representative Guinness.
So we have a letter that was just handed out to us from Dr. Daniel Engstrom and addressed to the chair. And it says he was one of the lead, this is the first paragraph, lead researchers along with other scientists from the University of Minnesota, Duluth, and the Twin Cities campuses. And he writes in this letter, these are my conclusions. Not my conclusions, the conclusion of the wild rice sulfate standard study. And I just want to see if you would agree with that. He says that the study strongly supports both the existing and sulfate standard for wild rice waters and also PCA's proposed equation-based revision of that standard. He says the standard is as clear and unambiguous as the results of any environmental research I have ever conducted. And finally, he says it's been thoroughly vetted through peer review. Would you agree, Commissioner, with those statements from Dr. Dan Engstrom?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I certainly agree with his first point, as we agree that the existing standard is scientifically based and the equation-based approach was rational. His third point about thorough vetting through peer review internationally, nationally, and across our own work, this is some of the most critically peer-reviewed science we have done. His middle point there is clear and unambiguous as what he's reviewed. I'm not going to comment on what he's reviewed, but from my perspective, having been a water regulator in three different agencies, this standard has been very thoroughly researched and the science has been solid. And so from my perspective, I would agree with his second point that in all my years of working on water quality and water regulatory standards, this is not an ambiguous approach.
Okay, members, we are quite far afield from some of the fiscal effects here. I've got Representative Houseman and Drazkowski, and then I'm going to cut off questions unless someone's got something that is very specific to the financial aspects of this, just in the interest of time here. Did you have another question, Representative Wagenius?
Well, I will when we talk about the fiscal again.
All right. Okay, Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just call out two of the sentences in the PCA letter on the second page where they point out the bill is based on the faulty idea that the science of wild rice and sulfate is not yet settled. Two international scientific journals have reviewed this, as he said. And then here's where this has been funded. On the third page, the bill prohibits the use of this new science regarding sulfate and wild rice. Science that Minnesotans helped pay for through the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment funding. So we've actually managed to put some effort into this with our own funding from that amendment. And then one additional line from Dr. Engstrom's letter in the last paragraph. The science supporting both the new and the old standards is far from antiquated. It represents the considered opinion of every independent scientist who has examined the evidence. We studied it, we paid for it, it's overwhelmingly affirmed by experts around the world, and we're going to nullify it.
Commissioner, do you want to respond to that? That's just a comment. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just would agree that that is our primary concern, that we would have no standard at the conclusion of this legislation passing, which I do not believe would be in the interest of the people of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, there was a handout handed around that looks at what the costs would be for water treatment facilities in the state, at least a handful of them here, with just the 10 or 15 that are listed here, they're surmising a $21 million increase in the cost of water treatment should your standard go forward without the correction that this bill brings forward. Commissioner, if you get your way, how are these communities going to pay for this $21 million?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'll be brief as I can because I know you're trying to wrap up, Mr. Chair. First of all, the bill requires the discharge to be upstream and have a potential impact on a downstream wild rice body. If that's true, then there's a calculation that must be sorted out in terms of the potential for harm and risk to the wild rice.
It may be that there's no requirement at all. Uh-huh. I believe what you may be looking at is the potential for a sort of a worst case scenario, assuming that it's within proximate upstream distance from the wild rice, of a wild rice listed water, and that there would be impacts, and the data from the sediments and the sulfate in the discharge concluded that there were a potential impact, then we would be looking at the feasibility of that for the community to afford. What we've done, we did this for mercury on Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. They're not required to meet a more stringent mercury discharge because they were granted a variance by the agency because it's practically infeasible for them to meet the requirements. If it's feasible, then they'd be required to construct. Many of the facilities that you may be looking at, and I'm not sure what you're looking at, but if it's infeasible under the law, communities can be recipients of variances to the requirements. That has happened across the state of Minnesota. We've granted variances now on sulfate, on chloride discharges, excuse me, not sulfate, chloride discharges to communities as well as mercury discharges where they're unaffordable. So if they're affordable, they would go through the Public Facilities Authority financing process, and the agency would assist them in designing their plant and going through the regulatory process.
Representative Gospelski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, it's kind of interesting. You talk about all kinds of variances that the agency is going to grant. That hasn't been the experience that I have observed or the people in Minnesota that I've talked to about your agency have described to me, so I don't believe you. But, Commissioner, what I'm looking at is a list of cities that include Duluth, Cloquet, Proctor, Hermantown, Esco, Scanlon, Carlton, Rice Lake, Twin Lakes, Pine Lake, Knife River, Oliver, Thompson, Renshaw, Jay Cook, Midway, MPCA, Landfill, Duluth, North Shore. Those are the ones that are listed here. But, Commissioner, who's going to pay the bill? How's it going to be paid for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joskowski, I believe you're listing all the communities that discharge through the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. I don't believe they're going to receive a limit for sulfate discharges on impacts of wild rice because the wild rice is growing upstream of their discharge point.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, if indeed they would be in a position to have to increase their water treatment costs and do the reverse osmosis and other things that are described in this brochure, who's going to pay the bill if indeed that's going to happen? Because I believe that it probably would be if we continue uninterruptedly on the current course.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joskowski, if there were to be a requirement, like all communities, there's a share of the funding that's apportioned to the state, generally through construction loans and grants, and then the communities pay back, and the people and the users of the system support those investments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Not another question, Mr. Chair, but I'll just help the Commissioner out. The taxpayers of Minnesota are going to get a tax increase, is what you're saying, Commissioner, if we continue on the current course. And if we don't change course here and adopt Representative Lewick's bill, there's going to be a tax increase, especially for the people in northern Minnesota, in their property taxes in those communities and likely others, but possibly for other communities in the state of Minnesota as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, I had said I was going to cut off discussion after Representative Joskowski, but I do want to recognize the minority lead, Representative Carlson, and then I understand we do have a proponent that wants to testify for the bill, so we can ask that person to get ready. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, mine was a question of you. We had several important documents that were handed out during the meeting, and will they be included then as part of the record, being that they won't be testifying? I want to make sure, for example, Dr. Engstrom's came out during the meeting, although I did understand he submitted it earlier. But there were others as well that were handed out during the meeting, and I...
Yeah, Representative Carlson, yeah, that's the standard practice, and we'll do that.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make sure that for the people in the audience, that they knew their testimony was going to be a part of the record, even if it was written.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wagenius, let me bring forward... You said you wanted to ask another question later. Let me bring forward the other testifier, and then we'll come back to you. Welcome to the committee. Can you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kelsey Johnson. I'm president of the Iron Mining Association. I represent the six iron mines that are operating in northeastern Minnesota and the two other facilities. Roughly, I represent about 15,000 employees that work directly and indirectly with the iron mines. I just kind of want to point out two things. First, if you have been in part of the policy committees and the other hearings, you would have heard some various testimony, and one of the things that you would have heard is that the science really isn't settled. And we've had a number of scientific experts come forward that have talked specifically to this piece of science, and that it really isn't settled. That's generally what we've heard so far from nearly every testifier. And they're specialists with regard to plant biology, limnology, hydrology, and a whole host of other things. That testimony has been entered with the administrative law judge. We've also, as part of the handout, you saw this was a testimony given by the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, the district out of the Duluth area. This was part of their testimony to the administrative law judge. What you can see is that they're estimating a $500 million investment up front. We've also submitted testimony to that effect. One of our mines basically said that they thought that it was going to be a $200 million investment in order to comply with this potential rule. Another testifier said that they would idle their facility earlier because of the cost to treat one of their pits. So finally, I just want to point out too, and the earlier testifier, Commissioner Winkstein, did not mention this, but variances require a schedule of compliance. So these costs will be incurred over the course of time, and that's a part of the variance process. So that's kind of just the final part of what I would like to say today. And I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Okay, any questions of Ms. Johnson? All right, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a letter here also from the Environmental Partnership. And in here, they state in the third paragraph, I believe, repealing the sulfate standard because it's unpopular with area industries that emit. You know, I find this to be a redundant line of attack, I'll say. Commissioner Stein talked about how what's going on here is an attack on wild rice. I think that this is an attack. What is being proposed by the people opposed to this bill is attack on the iron mining industry, and it's attack on the city. So my question for Ms. Johnson is that in here it just talks about industries that are opposed to, who want to have this bill passed. Who else is in favor of this bill, Ms. Johnson?
Ms. Johnson.
Thank you for that question. We've received letters of support from the Range Association, municipalities and schools, and they represent a wide swath of the municipalities and schools in northeastern Minnesota. They would be directly affected, according to their testimony to the administrative law judge. They would be directly affected as well. Millions of dollars in costs incurred to actually comply with this rule. We've had union support from IBEW, the construction trades, the operating engineers, the U.S. steel workers. We've had support from almost every chamber of commerce across the region. Small businesses would be greatly impacted by this rule change. So it's a very big coalition of people that are supporting this this legislation, because this is what we feel is our only recourse and our only step as part of the rulemaking process.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Johnson. We'll go back to other discussion on the bill then. Representative Lewick, I don't know if you have anything else you want to say. Representative Wagenius, you had said so you had a comment about the fiscal cost or something earlier that you wanted to say?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did. The reason I raised my hand before, when Representative Carlson said, are all the things going to go in the record, I would hope that when this goes in the record, we know who it's from. It doesn't say who wrote this. So if you would, just for the record, to be accurate. On the fiscal part, on page 3 of the bill, it says, the commissioner must, this is line 31, 331, must establish in a separate and prior rulemaking criteria to be used in identifying and listing wild rice waters. I did not see a fiscal note on that.
Well, Representative Lagunias, let me first say that I believe this particular item that you are referencing, this handout, is from the author, so we will categorize it that way. Representative Lewick.
Could you even point out the line that you're speaking of?
We're on page 3, line 31. It says, the commissioner must establish in a separate and prior rulemaking criteria to be used in identifying and listing wild rice waters, and it talks about then some additional information for the commissioner. But I had not seen a fiscal note on this and wondered if one has been prepared.
Representative Look.
At this point, there hasn't been one prepared. That whole Section 4 is in the context of both funding and the duty of the commissioner relative to standards to perform those types of evaluations. So this simply provides a fairly minor set of items that we would ask that the commissioner consider when they very specifically are doing something they're already funded and tasked to do. And that is go through the rulemaking process. This doesn't add anything particularly new. It simply makes sure that a couple things aren't missed.
Representative Lagunias.
Well, this actually says must, and listing all of these waters is not going to be a cheap undertaking. So I asked if there was a fiscal note, and apparently there is no fiscal note. We're just talking about $50,000 when this is going to be far more expensive than $50,000.
Well, Representative Lagunias, when I look at it, I see page 3, line 26. It's permissive. The Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency may evaluate the waters of the state. And if you go to page 3, line 28, the commissioner may, by rule, identify and list these waters. Then, basically, if the commissioner chooses to do those things, then they must do the other things that are listed starting on page 3, line 31. But since it's permissive, I wouldn't say that that would require a fiscal note, because we're not actually requiring them to do it. Representative Lagunias.
Well, first of all, it says before identifying and listing a wild rice water, the commissioner must. So, yes, there is a may here, but there's also a must here. And so you could read it two ways. You're reading it one way, that the commissioner may do it. So the commissioner does it. He must do this. But the other way to read it is, even before making that decision, he must, the commissioner is a he in this case, must establish a separate and prior rulemaking. So that's why there should be a fiscal note along with this request for $50,000.
I don't know. I guess I represent it. The way I read it, it starts out in the beginning saying at the beginning of the paragraph they may evaluate the waters, they may list these waters, and only if they decide to do that, then are they required to do these other things. So I guess it doesn't look to me like we need a fiscal note. Representative Lewick, it's your bill. What's your interpretation?
Well, absolutely. That is the intent, and in fact, that is a response from comments and direction that both MPCA has received and that a number of us have received over dissatisfaction with the extent and the way that the current waters were identified. So that was simply attempting to make sure that the voice of our Native Americans and tribal governments are clearly heard at the MPCA level, and so that when we go out and identify these waters, if we're going to go redo things again, please let's not leave a bunch of stuff undone, because frankly, what you've heard is exactly the kind of disagreement and questioning of the science that the administrative law judge folks found unacceptable, and so that's why that's where it's at right now. So this is simply an attempt to make sure that the voices are heard and that we get a response that will at least hopefully satisfy some real concerns voiced by the Chippewa Tribe of Minnesota well over a year ago.
Okay, well, members, a lot of discussion on this bill, most of it not relating to the fiscal aspect, but I'm going to recognize Representative Carlson, and then I think we need to move on. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was looking at the amendment here, and there's an account that I'm not totally familiar with here. It's the account in the Game and Fish Fund that is referred to as the Heritage Enhancement. And what is the intent of the Heritage Enhancement account, and what kind of money is in that account? I guess my question goes to the author. It was his amendment. I just would like some clarification. I, quite honestly, have no idea what the Heritage Enhancement account is within the Game and Fish Fund.
Representative Look.
Yeah, that's a fund that is designed to look at more than just straightforward things like do we have enough deer out there to satisfy deer hunters, or enough fish in the right place. It looks at a more general, looks at our general heritage of hunting, fishing, and harvesting natural resources. That, you know, certainly the staff can dig down into the precise line on that if you know, you need more information on that. But it's been there a long time and used for these types of situations.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess he referenced harvesting. I'm just trying to build a bridge here in my mind as to if that's the intent of that fund or not. But the second part of my question was what kind of money is in that fund? We're taking $50,000 out. I don't know if it's a large fund, a relatively small fund. I don't know if Mr. Marks has that at his fingertips or not. If he doesn't, we can get that number from him later, perhaps.
Mr. Marks, do you have that at your fingertips?
No, Mr. Chair. I did ask if there was enough money to cover the $50,000 was told yes, but I don't know any more about it. I'll find out more.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I guess my question then would be what kind of balance is left in the account after that transfer. Thank you.
Okay. All right, members, with that, I'm going to call for the vote. I'll renew my motion that House File 3280, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
A motion prevails. House File 3280, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Committee members, and Mr. Chair.
Okay, next up, we have House File 1415, Representative Albright. And members, I do want to say House Call 1415 is with us today because I think it's Rule 4.20 when a committee has asked something to the floor the prior year and it hasn't been acted on. It goes back to the Committee of Origin. So this is a bill that we actually did pass out of this committee last year, but is now back with us. So, members, we did have a discussion of this before. Chair will move that House Call 1415 be referred to the General Register. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have an oral amendment that I think just changes the effective date from 17 to 18.
Oh, okay. And where is that, Representative Albright? Page 5.18. Okay. Representative Albright moves on page 5, line 18. The date 2017 is changed to 2018. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1415, we have heard this in this committee and others last session. For a variety of reasons, the dating being specific, we're bringing it back to Ways and Means before it goes back to the General Register. Briefly, this bill does not expand the state of gaming in Minnesota. Fantasy sport contests have been played in the state for over 40 years. And the newer form of daily fantasy sports, which is just a new twist on fantasy sports, has been played in the state for more than 8 years. This bill does not expand those offerings. It merely provides a specific set of rules which operators must follow to continue operating in Minnesota. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, members, I'm not aware of anyone who has specifically requested to testify on this. If someone wants to, please let us know right away. Are there any questions? Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's a question or just some comments, and I've supported this in the past, and I think, you know, regulating the fantasy games is a good way to go. And I think it helps the fantasy game companies because they have certainty now versus uncertainty, which probably will actually help. But I do think there's a fairness question here with our charitable gaming organizations. I mean, you know, we tax them pretty heavily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are Lions clubs, there are churches, there are youth, there are veterans groups out there who pay a lot in tax. In fact, I think last year they paid about $60 million in taxes and put in about $62 million back to donations back to various groups and that. And where I'm thinking that, like DraftKings and these groups, they would be charged on the profits, I presume, and either be at our corporate rate at 9.8 or the pass-through at 9.85. But on our charitable gaming, they go from, and this is net receipts tax, from 9% progressive up to 36 on electronic and paper pull tabs. And I think on paper bingo and stuff like that, it's an 8.5. But at any rate, there is, our charitable gaming organizations will be paying a higher tax. And there's no doubt this is competition. So I'm not opposing this bill, because I think it's the right way to move. But I do think we really have a fairness question here to our groups. I mean, I know a lot of people who play the fantasy sports, but I actually know more people who are involved with these various organizations, whether or not it's our veterans or our church or youth groups or our Lions clubs, so to speak. So I do hope we maybe, and that's not in this committee, but even Chair David's maybe in the tax committee, we look at this again on just the fairness to our charitable organizations, because I think by passing this actually helps fantasy game companies, because it kind of verifies that this is legal versus then potentially not legal. And I think that will help them actually here to increase their revenues and profits. But I think at the same time, we have to come back and look at the fairness to our charitable organizations too. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, we've pretended we were the tax committee before, Representative Hawthorne.
We can do everything.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I recall that we had an amendment that was put on last year that brought this bill into balance. It was the fee from $500 to $1,500. And I see in the fiscal note there's a cost of $70,000 to the general fund. And my question, I guess, is of the author, was that a factored-in cost when the bill ref committee last year, that there would be a cost of $70,000? And I don't think we cover that cost. As I read the bill here, it would have to be taken out of HIDE within the Department of Commerce, is the way I'm looking at it. So if we could have some clarification from the author as far as the way the bill left after the amendment was put on that was putting it in balance, and now I see in the fiscal note, and maybe this has been there all along because it's been a year since we had the bill before us, but if you could clarify that, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Carlson, I think that underneath the fiscal note, everything needs to be kind of bumped back 1 year, so it would be really $50,000 for FY19.
Again,
but nevertheless, there is, I believe, a cost. Representative Albright.
Fiscal 19, I'm reading it at General Fund 70, but at any rate.
Right, but because we didn't enact it in 18. I think the $50,000 would now be for FY 19. But anyway, Representative Albright.
Either, whatever the number is, was it the way the bill left?
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, you are correct that there is a small bump to the general register, or for the general fund, but it does reflect a little as it left the committee last. But it also is in concert with the chair's perspective that it is not the $70,000, it is the $50,000.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, but whatever the number is, then the $50,000, I'll accept that as the number then, being it's year delayed, but we're not providing an appropriation for that, so then the department, just so we understand that, without an appropriation, they're being required to take that out of their current budget with no appropriation.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to agree with Representative Marquardt. You know, I've been carrying a bill, a House Call 226, many of you have signed on to, and we're talking about a fairness game here with charitable gambling organizations, and I've been working with those organizations for a couple of years now, trying to get something so that we'll be taxed on the net versus the gross incomes that are coming into these organizations, whether it's VFW, American Legions, or Lions Clubs, or whatever. So I agree with Dr. Marquardt.
Other discussion through the bill? Representative Albright, any comments?
I've been provided with some update to the question that Representative Carlson asked. It's anticipated that revenue will register actually 190 fantasy sports game operators times that $1,500. That will actually create $285,000 in revenue, which will more than offset the cost to the agency's budget.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, the way the intent was a year ago with the raising from 500 to 1,500 was to make it revenue neutral, so that's happening then, apparently.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Members, if there is no other questions or comments, and I see none, I will renew my motion that House Call 1415, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 1415 as amended is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, I'm going to take House File 2835, Representative Baker. Representative Baker moves that House File 2835 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Baker, you've got the A2 amendment, which looks to be kind of a technical amendment. You want to move that now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move that. It's a technical amendment. I can have staff explain that to us in a few minutes as well.
Okay, Representative Baker moves the A2 technical amendment. Is there any question to the A2 amendment? Seeing no questions, all in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Baker, House File 2835.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, we've spent a lot of time in this legislative session talking about the misfiring of MNLARS and the tremendous amount of money it has cost us and the pain and suffering from a lot of folks in Minnesota, not only our citizens, but our dealers and our deputy registrars. What this bill does is it actually is a bit of a disaster relief act to get to the 174 offices that have tried desperately to give good customer service with a very bad system, IT system that rolled out, and as we've all seen and read, has not done well in any way, shape, or form. It's functioning, it's working somewhat. They've got a lot of improvements to come. What this bill does is gets $9 million out from two separate accounts, and I have Mr. Lee here to explain it if we have more detail. I don't have much of a voice right now. But it really just quickly gets money out as a one-time fund to the deputy registers based on transactions and numbers of transactions. So this has been sort of agreed to by the Deputy Registrar Association and the group as a whole, saying this is the most fair and quickest way to get the money out to these offices that in some way are barely hanging on to staying in business. We've lost two Deputy Registrar offices since they've opened, actually since they rolled out MinLars at the end of July. You should have just had a handout from our friends up in Menominee County, and they are closed currently but are trying to reopen it in the next several weeks. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to just turn it over to Mr. Lee for a quick understanding of where the money is coming from. I have one short testimony from a deputy registrar in the audience, sir.
Oh, okay. Mr. Lee, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff. The appropriation for the $9 million comes out of two funds that are in the special revenue account that are for funding the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services. After the appropriations to fund the agency that was made in last year's budget bill, there was about $20 million remaining between those two funds in the Session Law 101 that was passed this session that appropriated about $10 million to the Department of Public Safety for fixes for MinLars and to the Office of the Legislative Auditor, excuse me. So after that $10 million appropriation, there's about $10 million left in between those two balances. So this bill would spend about nine of that between the two funds, and the amendment that you adopted earlier sort of ensures that there's about $500,000 between each of the two funds remaining.
All right. You have a testifier. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cindy Geis. I am the County Auditor Treasurer for Scott County. Also, I am the Property Customer Services Director. In Scott County, we currently have a county-run service center within our government center, and about 10 years ago, we received special legislation that allowed us to open a secondary service center down in the Elko New Market area. That legislation allowed us to open that with a caveat, and that caveat is that it wasn't going to cost the taxpayers any more money, which means we weren't going to hire any staff. So with that, we opened, MinLars was rolled out in July, of course, this last July, and within 3 days, it opened on Wednesdays, when we were first told that we could operate, by that end of day, Friday, we closed Elko New Market. And there were multiple reasons why we closed that service center. Number one, it was made extremely evident to us that we were no longer to be able to operate that service center with one staff. As you all know, the amount of things that we currently have to do now at the counter rather than what we did in the past is extremely, it takes a long time. So with that, our lines got very long, and we had to go back to our county board and said, we either have to add staff, provide overtime, extend those hours, and they did not want to do that. Now, with the fees that we were getting from that service center, MinLars did not work as it should have. We couldn't process transactions, so we were spending a lot of time with our customers and we're getting no money in. Our county board, along with myself and the senior leadership of Scott County, determined that we would close that service center. It does not bode well with our citizens down in Elko New Market area. It isn't a forever closure. It is, we will close when probably a few different things happen. Number one, we receive some funding. We receive some funding for what it will cost us in the future, as well as our current government center is underfunded, so we're already depending on property tax dollars or fund balance to cover those costs. Secondarily, we want to make sure that before we open that service center back up, that the system is fully functioning, that we're not looking for workarounds and zero transactions just to try to put a Band-Aid over a Band-Aid. We want it functioning before we open the doors. And then the last thing is that if additional funding is received, we know that we will have to add additional staff. And I don't know how that plays into the legislation that was passed 10 years ago when we guaranteed this body as well as other bodies within the state government that we would not add additional staff, because we know that that's not going to be the case on an ongoing basis. So with that, I will stand for questions.
All right. Any questions for the witness? Discussion of the bill. Any questions for Representative Baker? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going back to Mr. Lee's comment. I think this is one that I want to see resolved. I know Representative Hansen had a similar bill that was introduced, and I think I was a co-author. In fact, I know I was on that one. But an issue we want to resolve, but when you say that the two funds will be down to, what, $500,000 each as a result of the amendment, and I think the governor's proposal was general fund funding, so how fast do those funds build back up? I mean, I've been told all along that they're there for emergency purposes, and just asking if we're putting those two funds, or the department, I should say, at risk if they were to have an emergency, or how fast do they recoup building up those funds again?
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, the two funds are not specifically for emergencies. Both of the funds are used to operate the agency. The agency has a policy that they like to maintain a certain fund balance between the two funds for emergencies. But that's not appropriated to the agency. The legislature needs to act to give them the money. And did earlier this session the appropriation for MNLARS. So there's also a few changes in terms of revenue going forward. With the passage of the Real ID legislation last year, there was an extension of license renewals, which the agency estimates will increase revenue to the Driver Services Fund in the short term and then decrease it in the long term because people will have longer windows for a period on their licenses, which will essentially mean more fee revenue immediately but then less in over a 5 to 10 year period. In a sense, it will, if this legislation were to pass by fiscal 2020, the balances over and above the base appropriated amount for the agencies for both the Driver and Vehicle Services Fund would be about $9.4 million in fiscal 2020 and about $5.5 million in fiscal 2021, which is still below the reserve policy that the agency has.
Okay. That answers my question, Mr. Chairman, as to how quickly they begin to recoup. I've always heard that it was an emergency fund, but that be that as it may, I did notice that Mr. Lee used the term emergency. So I guess that's caught up in whatever the definition of an emergency is, but it is part of their operating budget, then, I think, is the main point that Mr. Lee was making. But I was just concerned that, being that the governor proposed general fund, that we not spend this down to the point where we create a problem for the department. Because I think the goal is an admirable one, to try to offset those costs to the providers. So thank you.
Representative Fabian.
I'll pass.
Okay. Other discussion of the bill? Seeing none, Representative Baker, any last comments?
Thank you for your support, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay, with that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House Bill 2835, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House Bill 2835, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Our last bill on the calendar today, our Representative Dean, House Bill 3023. Representative Dean moves that House File 3023 be referred to the General Register, and I see we have an A4 amendment that kind of looks like a technical amendment. Representative Dean, is that right? Is that a technical amendment?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Representative Dean, any comments or questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Dean, House Bill 3023 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill regards continuing education for prescribers looking at opioids, and what this does is it says that in order to get your license renewed that you have to have 2 hours of education within your CMEs for opioid training. This brought forward in both policy through finance and here. It's also moving in the Senate with Senator Benson. The reason that it's here is that part of the funds that it's going to require are from an SGSR account, which is the money that you pay the licensing boards to get your license. That's why it was redirected to this committee. And we've changed the bill along the way to put a sunset on this, responding to some of the input that we've gotten along the way within the other committees. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions regarding the bill.
Okay, questions. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Dean, is this, these two credits, are they within the current number of credits, or are we increasing two credits?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, this is within, and it's something that I don't like to do. I usually oppose, but just in response to the existing crisis and with the people out there who are should be getting this training but choose not to, we're shooting at them, and unfortunately some people are going to get it probably that maybe don't need it, but we're going to reach the people that do. And for that reason, we wanted to limit it for a certain amount of time so that everybody gets hit at least once in the next couple of years. And then if we have to kick it out again, we can. But don't want to do this unless we have to. And we would do this within the existing appropriation of ours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I represent Dean. I support the bill. You know that. I've said that in other committees. And I think on this particular issue, you and I actually are quite well aligned in how we want to approach this. But the question I have, I think I did ask this before, but I just want to bring it to your attention again, is that language about licensees with the authority to prescribe controlled substances. And I know you told me in another committee that that meant that they had a DEA license, I think. And I just wonder if you've had an opportunity to check that with any with staff or anything to see if that, in fact, is you know, is what that will mean. I'm just a little concerned about the, you know, whether that's definitive enough language there. Otherwise, I'm quite fine with the bill.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, we did with staff go through with the boards after your question. I believe it was in finance. And had heard back that the language was appropriate as is, and I'm happy to be corrected if that if there's an, another board that has a differing opinion, but I've not heard that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions for the author? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Dean, I'm curious on the amendment. Section 2A refers to the Board of Nursing. Is that because nurse practitioners can prescribe?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions for the author? Seeing none, any last words from the author?
I'll renew my motion that 3023 as amended be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Dean renews his motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House Bill 3023 as amended is referred to the General Register. Okay, members, with that, we're through the bills for the day. We will likely have another meeting later this week. We're getting quite a number of bills coming to us today, I understand, in session, and we have the budget resolution coming up one of these days as well, so watch your emails. With that, the meeting is adjourned.